Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you...
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight. No chaser. Well, the holidays are upon us, and we'll be talking about a little holiday break that I'll be taking in a little while. But first, I would like to tell you that we have an evening that is filled with a roundtable of the most distinguished, I believe, and respectful and talented actors that we have in the business. I've been knowing them for a long while. I'm so very, very pleased that they both agreed to be on this program, and I believe that it's going to be a very interesting conversation about the arts and how it's affected their lives and what they think about it, what they think is going on in our society today with being influenced with the arts. All of those things we're going to touch upon in a few minutes. But before I do that, as usual, I like to do a little housekeeping for those people who are tuning in for the first time because, and I see we do have some new numbers here, because you're listening to my guests and maybe they've invited you to come in and listen. So let me tell you how this works. You're listening to blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. What's important about those last few things is that that gives you access to the more than 40 episodes that I have recorded since we started in March. And they're all archived, they all have titles, and this will be available in about an hour after we finish this, and it'll be archived. Not only here, the video that we do later will be archived on YouTube under the Lenny Godfrey page. So that bit of information you should have. The other thing is that you should dial 516-453-6063 if you want to call in to say hello to our guests this evening. If you want a question, to pose a question for them, it's open for you to do that. We welcome all of that. And now, to get all of that out of the way, with all that being said, I now again welcome to you to Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser, and to my wonderful, wonderful guests who are participating in what I call my acting roundtable. We have the wonderful Marie Thomas and Mr. Count Stovall. Our lovely Elaine Graham had just a last-minute conflict, so she won't be joining us this evening, but she's here in spirit for us. So before I start, I want to tell you a little bit of what I've gathered about these two. First of all, these two people, I think, are magnificent in the fact that both of them have been recognized by the Adulco Awards many times. They have both have experience in daytime and evening television. Marie, specifically, not too long ago, before the pandemic, was at the Goodman Theater playing Sadie in the production of The Delaney Sisters, Sadie Delaney. And then she came back, and she'll tell me the correct pronunciation of this. And she played La Veuve, I think.
That sounds good, Lenny.
Yeah, okay, good.
La Veuve.
In The House That Will Not Stand at the New York Theater Workshop. But besides that, we have seen her act and sing on The Doctors. Oh, yes, Marie, I've seen those singing segments, yes. She played the character of a Laurie James there, She was also on One Life to Live, As the World Turns. She's been in films. She has done all these impressive things in performance. But the thing that that is most precious to me is that she has just retired as the artistic director of the most wonderful organization that I had an opportunity to participate in just a little bit, called the Children's Theater Workshop, the Peppermint Players. And this was a group of young people that she had been doing this for I don't know how many years, and I'm sure she's going to say it's been decades she started. Her commitment to young people and for them to use the arts in order to develop the discipline that has allowed some of them to grow up to be some of the actors that we see today in performance, as well as some of them have grown up to use those disciplines in other businesses. It's been exactly what this program has been talking about, how the arts can influence that. So I am so impressed. And she has inspired me, you know, so that I am the artistic director of a group. And she was my inspiration when I was thinking about all of it. Marie Thomas Foster is absolutely magnificent. And then I move over to the most wonderful and handsome mystic, Count Stovall. Now, Count gave me this short bio, and I'm going to read it because it applies to everyone on this program except for the children part with me, that he's an actor, a director, a film producer, a teacher, a writer. He's been on stage for over 55 years. Now, before I go to the other part of it, let me just say that Count, like Marie, has been in prime time and daytime television. He also was known as one of the leading characters, one of my favorite plays that I had an opportunity to do in Los Angeles called No Place to Be Somebody. He was Gabe, and it's just a wonderful role and experience recognition with that. He was a wonderful participant in the Doctors, as well as The World Turns. He's also done The Good Wife. He has been in the business and done probably everything that there is to do in the business, which is why I've asked him to come and join us. And along with that, the well-roundedness of his life is that he is the father of five. He's the grandfather of six. He's been a husband of 31 years. And I congratulate that wife on that knowing count. And with that, I welcome my two guests. Hello, Marie, and hello, Count. Welcome.
Hello, Lenny.
Hello, Lenny.
Thank you for coming in. Thank you so very much for coming and participating in this acting roundtable, because I think it's so very important that people know that or hear some of the things that you all think about, and I may join for a second or two about where the theater is now, where television is, where the arts are now, and I'm just very excited about asking you a couple of questions. One of the things that I want to start, and I want to start, usually I start with the ladies, but I'm going to start with Count this time, Marie.
So that's Count, all right.
Yep, thank you. So Count, you were born and raised in Los Angeles, am I not correct?
You are not correct.
Okay.
I was born in Los Angeles, but I wasn't raised in Los Angeles. I was raised in East Oakland, and I lived in Berkeley for a while and graduated from Salesian High School in Richmond, graduated from Merritt College in Oakland and UC Berkeley in Berkeley and the American Conservatory of Theater in San Francisco.
So in college, did you major in theater?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So what was your inspiration? What started that whole interest in the theater?
I wanted to write for television initially, and someone said, you have to do everything. And I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, you have to study theater. You have to study writing. You have to study philosophy. You have to do all of that. And I ended up doing it all. But it was just an accident that in the introduction to theater class, I was assigned to go see a play, which I had never done before in life. And on Monday, I said, I saw a play. Here's the program. Oh, no, Mr. Stovall. Get up and tell us about it. By the time the class ended, I got to the end of Act One, and the teacher and some of the students were sorely impressed with my improvisation and all my yakety-yak, and they invited me to an audition. And the rest, as they say, is black history, or my history.
It's not. I still have a question. How did you get? You're talking now. You're on the West Coast, so at least I got that part of it correctly. So you're on the West Coast. How? What? You are now on the East Coast. What was that journey? What got you here?
Well, I started out with San Francisco Shakespeare Company, and we opened the Shakespearean Gardens, and we did many plays around the Bay Area by people like Bullens and Amiri Baraka, et cetera. And one time I auditioned for a play called No Place to Be Somebody, which was the first play to win the Pulitzer Prize by Charles Gordone. And I was cast as Gabe Gabriel, as you said earlier. And I co-starred with Ben Vereen. And we did that at the On-Broadway Theater for X amount of time. And then I eventually went out on tour with it. And that national tour brought me to New York. And I eventually did it in New York, and I covered Philip Michael Thomas on Broadway as Gabe Gabriel, and then went on from there. And I never went back to California except to do some television work and some theater work.
So I've now gotten you into New York. Thank you very much. Now, Marie, I'm going to start. I'm going to go over to you. So how did it all start with you? And I know that Atlanta, if I'm not mistaken again.
No, that's right.
Thank you. It's the beginning of your whole, the start of your interest was where it started. But tell us the story now. How did that all start for you? The interest.
Well, I always wanted to be an actress, but everybody in my family was a school teacher, and of course, when you go to school and learn things, you're supposed to be a school teacher. Well, I wasn't interested in that at all. Mm-hmm. And Spelman started to have the very first major of speech and drama. And I think that simply the speech part was to make the academicians feel very good. But it was really about the theater. And I had two wonderful professors, Dr. Baldwin Barnes and J.P. Cochran, who as opposite as night and day. So I got really stretched when I worked with either one of them. It was really terrific. So I graduated from Spelman, and I with a major in speech and drama. So everybody wants to know, what are you going to do with that? I'm going to New York, I said, and I didn't know how, but I knew I was going to New York. Well, let me tell you, this is too funny because I have a girlfriend who is still living there, God bless her. She and I got a ticket to go see her sister in Washington, D.C. I had actually applied for a job at a community center in New York at Compton Avenue Baptist Church, believe that or not. Anyway, I hadn't heard from them, and so I said, well, I'm just going to go take this trip with Diane. And I remember giving my mother a kiss. She wasn't too excited. And my dad said something to me. He said, you've done everything we wanted you to do. It is time now for you to do what you want to do. Mm. And I said, yeah, you're right about that. So we get on this train. This train went on, and it stopped in every podunk town before it got to D.C. because it was a cheap ticket. It was like $27 round trip. Can you imagine that? That shows you how old I am. But anyway, we get to D.C., and all of a sudden my brother calls, or he sends me a letter saying that I have this job in this community center. And I said, oh, wow, I got a job. I can go now. Well, my mother never said a word. I just got on the bus, and I had my luggage, which wasn't a lot. And I stayed with a cousin of mine in New York, in Manhattan, Emma Amos, who turned out to be a wonderful artist. But I stayed with her for a little while, and then I went and I stayed with another girlfriend who was there, who had worked in the theater at Spelman. And I started my big-time job from 9 to 5, making about 20 cents. Well, it wasn't money at all. It was just covering my basic expenses, which weren't that much anyway. But the idea was I was in New York. So after that, how do I stay? I have to convince my mother I'll be okay. And so I auditioned for the American Theater Wing. My professors in Atlanta knew each other, and they said that the woman was looking, to hire Brown Chow. And I said, well, it's me. So I went, and I was so dramatic. I did these monologues I had done in college, and I actually done them quite well. And she was very impressed, and she said, now, do you live in Harlem? I said, yes. I didn't live in Harlem. I was on 9th Avenue. And I just said yes to everything. And I started, you know, with the techniques about theater, and had wonderful people that I worked with, and all of them. There was one Chinese boy, and then there was me, and another black girl, Judith Eason, who was really quite talented. So we were all there in the room, and I guess our teacher was Mr. Ed Sheeran. Mr. Ed Sheeran, who directed Great White Hope and also worked a lot on Law and Order. And so, you know, I didn't know what I was, you know, I didn't think the acting was all that, cut up. You know, you had to know this and you had to know that. And you had to have good speech, which I did and didn't have. I had a sibilant S. I didn't know what the hell that was. I thought, okay, whatever that is, I'll fix it. So I learned a lot in that year. And then we did a production of Our Town. Was it Our Town? Yeah. And I had already played Emily at Spelman, so I got the chance to play Emily again. And we did it in those little theaters down on 42nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, it was like, get a job, girl. What are you going to do? And I did. I got a job. I was a social worker director of recreation at Stuyvesant Community Center. And I worked with young people, and I taught dance, and we did all kinds of wonderful things. And then I got an offer to be in an off-Broadway play. So I was thinking about going home because I'd been there for 2 years, and I hadn't become a star. So I thought, I think I should just go home. My dad said to me, that's not like you. You don't give up that easy. I hung up the phone, and the phone rang again, and it was this gentleman named David Sell. And David Sell said that Joel Foster had recommended me for a part. I wonder, who is Joel Foster? Then I remembered of this guy who was in this group with me. We were all in a group, acting group. He used to sit in the back and just stare at me and grin all the time. I thought, oh, that's Joel Foster. I said, okay, so what is it? So, you know, the irony of that I will say in a minute. But the thing is, I went in and auditioned, and I said, but I can't do an acting job. I have a regular job that I work from 2 to 5 at this community center in Brooklyn, and then from 10 to 6. He said, well, this is a showcase, so we have to work around your schedule. So I said, oh, okay. So then the woman was supposed to be kind of exotic and whatever. I said, she's a ballet dancer in Syria. It's very strange. I said, okay, whatever. I put my hair up in a French twist. Because I had a lot of hair, and I was trying to make it look exotic, whatever that's supposed to mean. Long story short, I got the part. Not only did I get the part, but I got a husband at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes, I remember that Joel Foster person. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yes. I had to go look at this list of people that I had from the group. I said, oh, that's who that guy is. You know, he was kind of like a beatnik. You know, he was out of the 1950s. He had boots and, you know. Anyway.
Well, that was a journey. So let me pose to both of you. Was there anybody, once you got here in this atmosphere, in this environment, that you admired, that gave you an inspiration of any kind? Were there groups that you were interested in, or people that you were interested in to not replicate, but to also just disrespect it? Just did you respect what they were doing? Was there anybody that you had interest in? Count?
Initially, New York was a very large, very busy place, and it took an awful long time to learn how to work in this business, and an awful lot of minor jobs I took, from driving cab to working as a waiter in Max's Kansas City, where I met all kinds of jazz, and eventually, I joined a theater called the New Group Theater. There's another New Group Theater currently, but we ended up doing three productions. I went at the Public Theater and two other productions, and then we did a couple of Equity showcases at the Equity Library Theater. I played the lead in Rashomon and went on to be in White America. Yes? Oh, I thought you said something. Sorry. So after that, I got various breaks. One that you mentioned was The Doctors. That was my first soap opera of three. Went on to do that for a couple of years, and then went on to do another one some years later called As the World Turns, and ended up playing Detective Roy Franklin of the Oakdale Police, and went on to have, I guess, Tanya Pinkins was my love interest on that, and then some years later went on to do All My Children, brought to you by Palmolive. I played physical therapist, Cal Cummings, and I dated Debbie Morgan, who was Angie Hubbard, and ended up dating her and her mother, played by Lee Chamberlain. So that was my soap opera career, and the rest was theater, regional theater, Broadway, off-Broadway, and so on and so forth.
But I
remember very distinctly seeing the beautiful Marie Thomas in Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope.
Yes.
Oh, boy. I thought she was wonderful.
Yes. But specifically, there was no one who inspired you before or during your time when you first came to New York? Nothing?
Well, I didn't know a lot about acting per se. I didn't know that anything with us in it, you know, from Sidney Poitier and Ruby Dee in The Raisin in the Sun to James Earl Jones, you know, doing The Great White Hope, and any films or anything I saw with us in it, you know, really was quite marvelous as far as I was concerned. Ted Lange became a very good friend of mine. He was doing Big Time Buck White in San Francisco with Dick Anthony Williams. And these people became my friends, and I never had a sense that they were anything but just wonderful, and that being, I followed their example. Ossie Davis and Ruby became friends, and so the more people you met and the more people you worked with, the more exciting the work became. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I ended up covering for James Earl in a couple of Broadway shows. It was a lot of fun, you know. Ended up covering him in as Big Daddy and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and Driving Miss Daisy, playing Hope, and it was just great fun. And some people I had known from the American Conservatory Theater, Ellis Rabb directed a play on Broadway at the Vivian Beaumont Theater called A Philadelphia Story, and with Blythe Danner playing that Katharine Hepburn role as the lead. And I ended up being an assistant stage manager, and they needed somebody to play three different roles, a butler and a gardener and a cook. And they said, oh, well, get Count. He's got his equity card. He can do it. So I got all those checks and an assistant stage manager's job to boot, you know.
nothing like that triple threat trek, the triple threat paycheck.
Did I tell you one of the most inspiring people I met was an actress who was singing on a piano in a play many years later called Yubi, and I thought, wow, what a range, what a voice, you know. And I don't know if you know her, but a lot of people call her Lenny Gottfried.
Don't remember that at all.
Well, she was gorgeous and she was talented and she was impressive.
I will take a nod to that, Marie.
Yes.
I move on quickly away from me. What about you? You know, you were here. In that time period where there, you know, there were so many wonderful people around. What did you think about?
I never thought that I would do what I wanted to do. I don't know where that came from. So your self-esteem up to the top of my head. But I met Vinette Carroll. And I was married then, and I think Chris was a little, was Chris born? Maybe not yet. But I met Vinette, and she was looking for somebody to play Alice in Wonderland in this production that she was trying to put together. So I ended up getting the part because, ironically enough, I seemed to be having, they wanted in that little group of people, actors that I was in, BLS Productions, they wanted to do Alice in Wonderland, and they wanted me to do Alice. Here I am with Vinette doing Alice with people like Sherman Hemsley, and we did it at City Center, and it was just wonderful. It just, she was my mentor. She became my friend. She really took me where I needed to go. I just kept doing what I was supposed to do. And then after the Alice thing, ironically enough, I was pregnant playing Alice at City Center, and I didn't know it. So I had to pull myself in a little bit, you know, while we were doing it. But then the thing that I did the most with her primarily was she had a theater called the Urban Arts Corps, which was down on West 20th Street, 66 feet theater, 60-seated 66 people, and she did all kinds of things there. I did the Flies. I did Bury the Dead, which ended up being Step Lively, but just wonderful, magnificent pieces of work. And, you know, Vinette was incredibly talented. She was hard because she didn't, if you didn't get what it was she was talking about and she really couldn't explain it, you might be gone the next day. So that was what you call that place, the revolving door, you know. But I got along very well with her. And then Cope came back to New York, and she wanted me to be in the play and to be Mickey Grant's understudy in the play. So I said, okay, that's fine. I got in it. It was getting ready to go up. It didn't go up right away at the Edison. It was at a theater right on 9th Avenue and 40-something Street. And Mickey, we were in rehearsal. Now, this is a funny story. Her manager, I had left, and she was in there talking. Mickey was in there talking to Vinette. And I left to go get lunch, and her manager was in the lobby, and she said, where's Mickey? I said, she's in with Vinette. She says, I have terrible news. I said, what? She said, her father passed. I said, oh, dear. I said, well, she's in fine. So I went on out the door, not thinking about anything. And I got halfway down the street. I said, oh, hey, if she has to go home for a funeral, that means I got to do this part. So I said, okay, fine, just steady your feet. You know you can handle it, you know. And working with Vinette was easy for me. For a lot of people, it wasn't. And so she did go. I think I went on about 3 or 4 times or something like that. And it really turned out to be quite well because Vinette had a little difficulty directing Mickey sometimes because Mickey had a mind of her own, and this was her music. But Vinette took that music and made a production out of it. Mm-hmm. We found out, you know, Mickey just recently passed, and there was a funeral service for her at Riverside Church. Well, Gloria Van Scott, who's an actress, got up to speak, and she said she met Mickey on the West Coast, and they came back to New York. They were friends. She took this music that Mickey wrote to Vinette, just music. There was no play. So then she said, oh, my God, Vanessa, this is terrific. We need to do something with this. So the title came about as a result of Gloria saying there was a friend of hers who was driving, and somebody hit her in the back, and she got out of her car to walk back to talk to the lady, and the lady said, don't bother me. I can't cope. And that's where the title came from. So Vinette put it together and made it was called a musical review. It was not called a play or a musical. It was a musical review, which meant that it had substance in it about various things, a very political piece. And I stayed in it about 9 months, and I had an audition for two things, one for a play that was going to be at Lincoln Center and the other a musical. So, no, it's the, and then it was The Doctors. So then I got on the show. I stayed in the play until the end of the year, and then I went on The Doctors. I think the first airing was in January of 72. And I worked with a lovely gentleman, Palmer Dean, very handsome and very kind person. And I said, oh, this is great. This is just what I want to do. I want to be on television. So, but It was a wonderful moment because I just wasn't your regular walk on and say two lines and, you know, take care of the children and, you know, all of that genre. Mm-hmm. I was a nightclub singer. I had been a nurse, and I lost and I went off to sing in the nightclub, and then I lost my voice and I returned to New York, and then I somehow or another the storyline got me back to the hospital to my beau. And it was just great. I met wonderful people. I was there almost 3 years, and then producers changed and the show changed, and I didn't watch the show very much afterwards, you know. But had a ball. It was a wonderful time.
Yeah, both of you have had incredible experiences, and you know when I had a round table before, and it was with dancers. Wonderful dancers, Broadway dancers, Leah Bass, Julia Lima, and Leslie Dockery. And one of the things I asked them was what they thought about the dance then when they go to the theater now. What about the dance affects them? What kind of investment do they think that is in it? And one of the things that came out of their conversation was the fact that they thought that dancing now was far more physical. When I say that, gymnastic-like.
Yeah, athletic.
Less organic and less organic, less telling of the story, less filled with turns and twists and everything else, but you feel nothing. So I asked this of both of you when you go to the theater now, having been in the theater for all these years, having done all the kinds of things, both of you have done everything that there is to do in our business, I believe. How do you feel about what you're seeing now when you go to the theater? I'm going to pick on Count first. Count.
Okay.
Yes. Well, what are we seeing on Broadway? Very large musical, a la Moulin Rouge and Hades Town. And it's very exciting. These are huge productions. I mean, I go back to when they first did Hair back in San Francisco and New York. And you know, it's changed the largeness, the expense of what a musical is all about. And we've had some very fine writers in this day and age, most of them, that I fall in love with are black female writers, from Lynn Nottage to Dominique Marceau, you know, just many other female writers. It's a great time to be a woman writer, both on television and today. And the directors are changing. There's a lot more female directors. So there's a lot more opportunities. I mean, that doesn't mean it's equal on any level, but there's still a lot more opportunity, and I worked for Marie Thomas and used to watch her work with these children. She worked with them for 40 years and created you know, theater for children and put them on the Victoria stage at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. And you know, this kind of thing taught me, because I was a teaching artist for many, many years, something like 35 years. And ran the Newark Community School of the Arts and the Summer Youth Performance Workshop for about nine years, connected to the Arts and Education Program at New Jersey Performing Arts Center. So watching these young people come out of school, watching the students of Marie come out and perform, you see them on television, you know, and just all kinds of shows. And there's one of Marie's students. There's one of Marie's students. Oh, there's one I worked with in this and that. You know, it's just grand. It's very gratifying, very satisfying.
Marie?
Oh, well, I don't get to go to the theater that much anymore, but I will be going to see Hadestown next Tuesday, I think. The director that I work with in two plays, in Knock Me a Kiss and also Having Our Say, will be in town and called and asked if I wanted to go to the theater. I said, well, you know what? I would love to see Andre in Hadestown, because I heard Count talk so much about it. And then, of course, he won the Tony, God bless him. I work with him, and I love working with him because he's serious. You know, he's real serious about what he does, and he works hard and beautifully. But I saw something, I'll just say, that kind of shocked me. Now, I came out of New York Theater Workshop doing The House That Would Not Stand with wonderful black actresses, Linda Gravatt and Harriet Foy, and three very, very talented young women. And I said, oh, boy, this is really interesting. And I didn't have a lot to do because they'd asked me to do it before I came back from Chicago. I said, I was trying to go home and go to bed. But I thought, all right, I'll look at this script. Having our say took me around the bend, but I loved doing the play. It was just hard work. And so when I came, I said, I'll only do it if it's not so much to do. And I had an opening part in the show. I opened the show, and then I came back for the second act for a few minutes, and all the rest of them were working and working beautifully. Now, this came out of New York Theater Workshop. So did Slave Play. I don't know if you know anything about that.
No.
That went to Broadway. Well, you look it up and read it and take a look at it. But I sat there in total amazement as to why was this play chosen. I think I know why. I don't take anything from the young man. I think he's a gifted writer. And there was a seminar held with him in Montclair Museum. People had it, and I went. And I said, well, what did your mother think about it? Because it was pretty, I can't say the word that I want to say, but it was pretty open. And he said, my mother loves all my plays. I said, oh, that was the wrong question for me to ask. I didn't say, I didn't ask any more questions that night. But I admired him. I liked him. But, you know, he talked about his life and how long it took him even to get to this juncture. And I can appreciate that. I love good acting more than anything, and I've been happy to help young people go forward. You know, I taught at City College for 12 years professor, full-time, and 8 years as an adjunct. And those young people, I just adore them. And you know what, people fuss about Facebook, but I love Facebook because I get messages from them all the time, which makes me feel like something was accomplished in those classrooms. Mm-hmm. And I see them when I go to L.A. and other places. But I can't really tell. I think Lynn Nottage and play Sweat, and the one I want to see now, Clyde, I think, is up now. And Dominique Marceau and Ava DuVernay and all these people, these women are just rocking. I just think they're wonderful. Mm-hmm. I admire them. I have plays the Count keeps telling me that I need to get published, you know, the plays that I did with the kids. But it was about African-American history. And who has plays like that? Nobody really necessarily. So I'm thinking about that, Kyle. I'm thinking
good.
About it.
Good.
I agree.
Do it for the children.
That.
Do it for the children.
And, and because no one is doing it, then it should be done, you know?
Yeah.
I think that makes it rare, the fact. Both of you have named musicals, and some of the authors of plays. Do you have any specific plays that you do really admire, that you've seen? Plays, now, not musicals.
Plays.
Because there is a different methodology to the American musical theater environment.
Yeah.
It's different. It's approached differently than a play. Both of us, you know, all of us have been in both.
Yeah.
And the approach is different, you know. So
Can I move
away from, you know, musicals, and I go into plays. What do you think?
Well, I quite frankly, I have to say that Having Our Say is a gem. I mean, it is a gem. It came from the book. It came from the mouths of those two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the book long before it was put into a play by Emily Mann. And I love those two women because those two women are in my family. And my sister came to Chicago to see it. My sister and my brother and Cal came, and several other friends of mine came. And my sister wrote a lovely thing about how she wished that our relatives were alive because they would see themselves on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And you know something, Lenny? I took a lot of how my grandmother talked and acted and carried on, and a lot of it was in the presentation of Sadie. And I understood Sadie from one end to the other. Bessie was a much more open character that just, you know, and it was played lovely by Ella Joyce. We got to be really good sisters by the end of it. But Ella was more extroverted than I was, than my character was. But mm-hmm. what I loved about it was she would do some silly stuff, and I'd stare at her with my cutting my eyes like, are you serious? That's what my mother, that's what those ladies did. If you went someplace and you didn't behave very well, they would cut those mm-hmm. eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just loved doing it. It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life because I was old and I had to act. You know?
Oh, very hard. No.
I remember all those words. One night I forgot the whole family. I forgot the whole family. And so the stage manager said, Marie, did you realize you forgot the family? I said, no, I didn't realize. I was just talking. I said, was Chuck there? They said, no, I feel good. But it was so one night I was turned around the bend. My mind just went off the tracks. And God bless Ella, she brought me back around, you know, to where I was supposed to be. But the loveliest moment I ever had, not necessarily in that play, was in Knock Me a Kiss. And she was the withered widow, not widow, withered wife of W.E.B. Du Bois. He treated her rather badly. And all she did was try to get off and survive and, you know, be able to do her thing. And all the time she was drinking tea. And the very last line of the play, when my daughter had been decided she didn't want to be married to the guy. What's his name? I forget. Anyway.
County Cullen.
He was, thank you, baby. He was, count is my mind. Anyway,
he's your memory. Count, huh?
Yeah, he's my memory. Thank you, Count.
Mm-hmm.
He was gay, and, you know, that was the twist in the play. So at the end, I'm consoling my daughter, and I'm getting up. After I tried to console and say some things, and then she said she would like to have a cup of tea with me. And I said, with me? You want a cup of tea? And she said, yes. I said, well, you'll have to wait a moment because I have to find another cup. And I just could feel that woman when she said, oh, she was so excited. Her daughter was paying some attention. And the only thing she could say was, you have to give me a moment to find another cup. And I thought that playwright, you know, when I read that thing, because I wasn't even going to audition for the thing, you know, I had reached a crazy place in my life. And the guy called me. He said, Marie, did you get the information about the audition? I said, what audition? He said, I sent you the play. I sent you the so-and-so. I said, oh, would you mind sending it to me again? And I always didn't want to find a moment. I don't need to do the whole play. I don't need to be in every single scene. And when I read that, I called him back and I said, yes. Now, when do I come in? He says, well, can you come? We're on callbacks. Can you come about 5? I said, are you kidding me? I'm not going to New York at no 5 o'clock. Yeah, I'm just being crazy. He said, Marie, just come anytime, please. I said, okay, I will come at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock or something like that. And sure enough, all the lovely ladies who all could have done the same, you know, were there. But I knew that part was for me. You know, there are times when you know things are yours. And I just went home and didn't say anything about it for the next couple of days, and then I got the call because it was being produced by New Federal Theater. That's Woody King and his people. But Chuck was the director. He came out of Chicago. They had done it in Chicago, and they came to New York to do it. And so there was a few more coins given to us other than the $2.98 that we would get most of the time. So I didn't mind, and then the play just took off. It just went to the National Black Theater Festival. It was done at Crossroads, and it was done at National Black Theater Festival twice, as a matter of fact. And Chuck is a resident director of the Goodman Theater, and he had said to me in 2016 that he wanted to do Having Our Say, but they weren't ready to do it, and it wasn't until 2018 that it came up. And he had worked with Ella before, so we were sisters in the play, and the Goodman accepted it, you know. So it was, and that theater is beautiful, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. You just, you know, that was my next question, what inspired you. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
But that was the next question, and so since you've answered it before that now, I got to go back over to Count Stovall and say,
okay.
So all right, now Marie has talked about one of her most memorable experiences. What's one of your most? And understand now, in this hour, we're less than 15 minutes away before we only have about 14 minutes left. That's how fast this hour goes. So if anyone wants to ask these
That's
wonderful
the,
people
the host,
any questions,
the hostess,
you know.
It's the hostess is so debonair and so sophisticated. She makes the time just fly.
Oh,
she brings out the best.
If they could see us,
we were in tears, you know, just like on the Oprah Winfrey show. You know?
No, not on Oprah Winfrey.
No, Lydia is nowhere near like Oprah Winfrey. Thank you.
Yes.
No.
One of the things that does interest me is what is the most intriguing or refreshing experience that you've had in performing, period. I won't say the theater. I just say we'll say performing, period. Count.
Well, I guess it's almost like a play, beginning, middle, and end. Beginning, I started out with Shakespeare, which eventually led me to one of the greatest roles that I have done in my entire career, Gabe Gabriel in No Place to Be Somebody. He was not only a character in the play, he wrote the play, and he was the Gregorian or the Greek chorus of the play, and he did these wonderful monologues. One of them was, "There's more to being black than meets the eye."
Meets the eye.
And,
yes.
Yeah, that's right. And the poetry was just wonderful. Think of Dunbar, for those of you who never saw No Place to Be Somebody. Think of Paul Laurence Dunbar and the kind of speech he was able to do, you know, like The Party is a Dunbar classic. You know, there was a great big party down at Tom's last night. Was I there? You know, and they just go on and on and on. And some of the beauty in his writing. And then as we get into the middle of my career, beyond television work, which was, you know, always very new and exciting, there came Broadway. And Broadway came in the small role in the Philadelphia Story, as I told you before. But also I started working with an all-black cast and a black producer, Stephen Bird and Aaliyah Jones Harvey, you know, two of the most famous black producers in history, I would imagine, because they produced over 13, 14 Broadway shows. But they put us on the map with Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
We eventually did
Streetcar Named Desire and some other plays on Broadway. Now, Broadway is supposed to be the penultimate, and those of you who have read the book called Footnotes, which talks a great deal about Shuffle Along back in 100 years ago, 1920, 21, you start to find why Broadway seemed to be the place where we were forever striving to be, and then finally getting to be and almost, you know, taking over and changing Broadway. The book is Footnotes by Gaines. But, you know, that was quite something. You know, I didn't know these dressing rooms were so small and Broadway. This is Broadway. But it was. And
yes,
I ended up doing several
and
plays.
Those same theaters are still some of those same theaters we had the ability to perform.
Absolutely.
In.
The Broadhurst,
you know, yes.
And the Golden,
yes, exactly.
Et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're here and they're being used today.
Today.
So that was a very exciting thing, being brought to Broadway and then eventually doing, you know, various Broadway shows. But I think the most exciting thing was when I conquered a fear that I'd had for all over a half century, and that was singing. I was supposed to do Scrooge and A Christmas Carol, and I had done Mr. Fezziwig and Old Joe in a couple of productions at the McCarter Theater before. So when he said, when I was asked to do Scrooge and A Christmas Carol, I said, "Oh, sure, I can do that." But he says, "And there's kind of singing in it, you know." I said, "Well, I'm not really a singer." He said, "Oh, no, just a couple of songs, just talk singing, like My Fair Lady, or what's his name in Camelot. And he says, "Oh, you."
Yeah, between Rex and Richard.
He
yes.
lied to me. I ended up singing a large variety.
Fabulous.
Of
I
studied
I know
and
was.
Studied
I heard
and,
about it.
And,
yes.
And God bless, Marie was there to cheer me on. As you hear, Marie and I have supported each other's career, you know, over the years for a long, long time, and rightly so, because Marie's performance is not to be missed. It's what Shakespeare called devoutly to be wished if you can catch a Marie Thomas performance. Anyway, that show had me moving and running and jumping around at my age, which is in the late 70s at this point. I was able to sing and work with young dancers, and it was so exciting. And it was what a relief. And I said, well, if I don't ever work again, this was sort of one of my, you know, penultimate moments. And those are the three areas of my 55-year career that I enjoyed the most. Thank you for asking.
it's so funny to hear it. First of all, we share a love for this play, No Place to Be Somebody, because I had the opportunity to do Cora Mae Beasley in Los Angeles with Charles Gaudin directing it with Bill Duke. And to be exposed to that kind of theater was absolutely the most wonderful experience in the world for me. And so I share the love for the play. I share the experience with some wonderful actors that I did it with. I would have loved to have done it with you, Count. It was, Cora Mae is just a wonderful character, and the woman, I believe, who created her, Mary Elliott, is just a wonderful...
Mary Alice,
creator Mary Alice stood by for Mary Elliott. Mary Elliott created it, yes. So Yes, thank you very much. When I research a part, I research it to the end, and I give the credit to Miss Elliott for creating such a wonderful and incredible character for those of us, you know, who got an opportunity. And, of course, working with Mr. Gaudin was absolutely brilliant. I mean, he was just divine to work with. So we share that. And, Marie, I share the love that you had and the brilliance and the investment that you had in it with your students. It's just incredible what people don't know, because they would have to be there to watch it, but I watched it year after year after year. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And was, you know, and had an opportunity to work with them for a little bit. Just sharing both of those, and I say that, and I segue this, having done all of this wonderful things. What do you all want to do next?
Go to bed. You know, the funny thing about this pandemic, people say, oh, my goodness, it's a pandemic. I said, well, what are we supposed to do? You're just supposed to stay inside. I said, oh, that sounds good. I don't have any responsibilities. My children are gone and grown. I don't have to teach. I don't have a job. I did get a job during the pandemic, though. I went down to Atlanta to do MacArthur. And that was via one of those self-tape things that we all have to do, no matter how we hate it. But we have to do it. And then what was beautiful about that is Shannon majored in broadcasting at Temple. And so Shannon has a very good affinity, or she knows how to put stuff together and send it off to the moon or wherever it's supposed to go. So I did get a chance, and I got a chance to go home, because I was planning to go home just as the pandemic struck, you know. And I said, well, I guess I'm not going. So I got a chance to go home and see my sister and my brother and then plus have a job. And it was a delight. It was a nighttime television thing. Child, if I could get about three or four of those, I could seriously retire. But at any rate, I had a wonderful time doing it. And the young people on it, I'm always interested in young people, were just as lovely and easy, no diva dishing, do it, you know, just, and the lead guy, Lucas Till, was just a delight. And what they did with this, he's supposed to be the son of the original MacIver. They had an African-American young man on there, they had an Asian girl, and they had a young girl who looked like she could be Middle Eastern. So I said, that's how you cast. That's how you let kids grow up and see the diversity in our world. You know, I had a good time.
Well, and that was, we were running out of time, because that one of the things that I wanted to talk about, of course, was diversity. But Count, before I end this down, what are you going to do? I mean, we look forward to the work that you all have done thus far. I mean, what else?
Very, very briefly, Lenny, I was very excited because I was able to co-produce, actually, a documentary called King Arthur and the Count, and it was about my about 60 years of blacks on Broadway. That was the subject of the documentary, and it was called King Arthur and the Count because the original idea came from my dear friend, my late friend, Arthur French, who's a magnificent actor. You just have to Google Arthur French.
Yes.
And so
yes.
King Arthur and the Count was this documentary I produced, and then it had wonderful people in it. And you can get it. You can get it on Amazon, et cetera, and you can get it into your home. Another thing I did was a very short film, a 28-minute film that was directed by Estelle Parsons called A Man of His Time. And it was about a descendant of what's his name? anyway,
Charles, something with a T.
Anyway, it was a famous trial. It's
the trial. Oh, yes.
And the descendant of the judge and Dred Scott. That's the Dred Scott. Dred Scott and the descendant of the Chief Justice who had this ruling that blacks were nothing that blacks did, you know, had to be taken seriously by whites. This is a 28-minute short film directed by the Oscar winner Estelle Parsons, and I loved it. And so I would like to produce more documentaries, and I would like to do more films, some short, some full length. Wonderful. Glad to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think thank you, Lenny.
You know, but truly, I think that you all, both of you, have to know that people want to see more from you, want to hear more from you, because as much and as wonderful as the young people are today and how they contribute to everything that we're doing today, we also look forward to those people who can bring the experience of history there. You talked about 1921. One of the things that I've been privileged to do, being associated with the most wonderful man, UB Blake, is to understand the accomplishments that UB Blake did in 1921 by having Shuffle Along on Broadway, which people don't even realize that because there was so much traffic, they had to change the direction of the street that the theater was on. You know, they had actually, they no longer had matinees in the day. They had a midnight show because all of the performers on Broadway wanted to come and see Shuffle Along. And so there was an adjustment. There was a social impact as well as a theatrical and creative impact for Shuffle Along. So I think that there's a lot of things that can be said and highlighted. And I want you all to be involved in all of that. And I'm not giving up until I see you all on Broadway stages again.
You know, when Curly came on, that's when the Sunday matinee came. Did you know that? Because there wasn't a Sunday matinee prior to that. Because Pete Rose, I think, realized black people would come to the theater from church on Sunday. He started the Sunday matinee,
But, you know, I mean, but there's a lot of history in how we contributed to form Broadway the way it is that has really not been pronounced enough. And that needs to be, you know, that needs to be something that we work on. But now we're down to less than a minute and a half left in this show. And I want people to know that, you know, there, even though we have many telephone listings here, it's going off of my screen. No one has called to ask you all a question. They've just been fascinated by what you've had to say, and I'm really, really glad about that, but sorry that we're going to end this, but continue it on Zoom in the After Show Afterthoughts, where we get a chance to see you and then enjoy each other for a little bit. After a little bit of break, you all have the information. I just want to thank the audience so much for joining us this evening to let them know that next week I wish everyone the most wonderful Thanksgiving. I won't be on air next week. I will be on air the week after, and possibly it will just be me, and it will be the opportunity that people have of saying that they want to call in and ask me questions about me. So that may happen if I cannot get my wonderful another guest who's very, very busy, who may not make it that time. So we'll see, and I'll always let people know. But, Count, I want to thank you so much. Love you dearly.
My pleasure, Lenny.
Yes, really. And, Marie, you know I love you. You know,
I love you back.
You know, and I thank you for introducing me to Count, because it was you who brought me to who had a function that Count was there many years ago, and that introduced me to Count, who I'd heard so much about over time. So I love you both.
Cool.
I will see you both in a little bit, And
you'll have to tell me that story later, Lenny.
Oh, I will. All right. I'm going to sign off now. And before we start telling too many stories on this air, on the air. Okay. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, and I'll see you the week after that. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you